This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a new release. I'm Keith Phipps, here this week with Scott Tobias, Tasha Robinson, and joining us from behind the scenes, producer Genevieve Kosky. We're all veterans of the film site The Dissolve, where one of our guiding principles was that no film exists in a vacuum, and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we're getting together to look over a new release and how it relates to a major movie from the past. Genevieve, what's this week's movie pairing?
We're recording this podcast shortly after the release of The Good Dinosaur, the 16th feature film from Pixar, and the second one to be released in 2015, 20 years after the release of Toy Story in 1995. The studio has come a long way since then. Pixar is now a familiar brand name like Disney. In fact, Pixar developed Toy Story with Disney, which after a lot of complicated legal wrangling and behind-the-scenes politics, purchased Pixar in 2006. Over the years, Pixar's technological advances let it create images no one could imagine when Toy Story hit theaters.
But in some ways, Pixar hasn't changed that much. Look at Toy Story and you'll find the company's core sensibility already in place. The film uses humor, well-rounded characters, strong visuals, and carefully doled out pathos to tell a story about how we're defined by our dreams and by the bonds we form with others, and how time and outside forces threaten to change both of those defining elements. There's a direct line between the friendship forged between Buzz and Woody in Toy Story and the perils faced by the unlikely friends of the dinosaur Arlo and the cowboy Spot in The Good Dinosaur. We'll kick off this week's discussion with a deep dive into Toy Story, talking over its animation, its storytelling, and the intangibles that have made Pixar a dominant force in filmmaking. Then, in the second half of this week's episode, dropping later this week, we'll bring The Good Dinosaur into the discussion, talking about how the two films relate, or don't, and how Pixar has evolved in the 20 years between their release. So grab a moving buddy and watch out for Sid and Scud. We're headed back to Andy's bedroom circa 1995.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said, or you got a friend in me.
Yes. It's now almost hard to imagine a world of animation before Pixar, but it wasn't so long ago. In 1994, Disney's The Lion King shattered expectations by becoming the highest-grossing animated feature of all time. It continued the Disney renaissance begun in the late 80s and seemed to ensure that Disney would remain the dominant force in animation for the foreseeable future, and that traditional hand-drawn animation would remain the norm. But Disney had already started combining traditional animation with computer animation. A company called Pixar, which had been creating graphics hardware, software, and short films for a few years, provided computer-aided assistance to Disney on several features in secret. But Pixar's contributions to Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin were more prominent, allowing both films to create textures and effects that wouldn't have been possible with traditional animation. And the technology Pixar pioneered helped The Lion King create shots that would have been prohibitively expensive just a few years earlier. That, however, didn't make Pixar's future a sure thing. The company, whose roots go back to the 1970s and whose history includes a stint as a division of Lucasfilm, consistently lost money for its heaviest investor, Steve Jobs. It also had an ongoing identity crisis. Would it make money creating graphics hardware, software programs, commercials? Pixar put out a series of acclaimed short films, but they are mostly seen by animation fans and Oscar voters. When Toy Story, the company's first feature, premiered in November 1995, it was accompanied by a certain amount of skepticism about whether computer-generated animation could sustain a feature-length film. 20 years away from that skepticism, we can talk about the movie from a different perspective. So, without any further ado, let's get started. I'd like to talk about first impressions. Let me start with you, Genevieve. You were the target audience for this film when it came out, or the rest of us were a little bit older.
Yeah, I was 12 when Toy Story came out, so... all right, guys.
A little bit older.
Oh, my God.
Everyone's making faces at me. Yes, I was
86 when it came out.
I was 12 when Toy Story came out. So I really only have the vaguest memory of seeing it that first time. But I know that I saw it in the theater with my mom. And while I can't be certain, I don't think that at that point I was really recognizing or processing that this was a different sort of animation than I'd seen before. Like, maybe I thought it looked a little different, but I think at that point I was more invested in the stories and the characters than this new type of animation. I think I just processed it more as a kid would than as a film, you know, a cinephile would. So it was interesting coming back to it now. I do remember thinking of it at the time as a Disney film. Because I came from a Disney family, you know, I grew up during the Disney Renaissance that Keith mentioned. So going to see the latest, you know, Disney animated feature is always a big deal for me and my family. And, you know, Toy Story was featured at Disney World and the Disney Store. So at that point, I very much thought of it as a Disney film. Going back this time, it was interesting to watch it as a Pixar film in the context of what that means today. And I'm sure we'll get into that a lot more. But I want to hear from you guys who were fully formed adults when Toy Story came out.
Well, I was 70 and then I started aging backwards. Like in
Benjamin Button.
Yeah, exactly.
Your
like
favorite
Benjamin
film.
Button. In 1995, I was 24. So there's a little bit of an age gap
so
there.
So you were double my age.
I was double your age. Yeah. And I actually have a very distinct memory. I mean, for one, context-wise, when I was writing for a student newspaper, you know, I wrote a scathing review of The Lion King, in which I called it a horrible racist film. So I was like the original deliverer of hot takes.
Was it because of the hyenas?
It was the hyenas, yeah. Right, exactly. You know, but I do recall, you know, seeing it with family, extended family, a lot of us going, I'm not sure, when did the film come out?
November.
I think maybe it was a Thanksgiving thing. We all went to the multiplex together. And I think the idea was that we were going to entertain our nieces who were a little bit younger than you were at the time. But what struck me then was just how entertaining I found the film. To my surprise, I think. I mean, I guess the Disney films sort of primed you as an adult to respond to them and to appreciate them. But, you know, I remember thinking, you know, I was there with probably four generations of Tobiases, and everybody was really entertained by it. And the film really struck a chord. And I think it's something that has kind of carried through with Pixar, because Pixar has that depth and speaks to adults and kids, you know, simultaneously. And that happened here too, and I think it certainly followed through with the sequels and the other films that Pixar has made.
I was a film critic at the time, not a fully formed one or a fully formed adult. I'm not sure I'm a fully formed adult now, Genevieve. But what I was much more so was an animation buff, like a really hardcore, had very, very strong opinions about animation. And that had less to do, like my impression of The Lion King had very little to do with the racism or the it's ripping off Hamlet or any of the other things people got angry about it. For me, it was such an exciting animation experience. So for me, like the launch of Toy Story, like I went into that movie expecting to hate it because I had very strong feelings about computer animation. The computer animation of the time was very crude and very clunky. It was full of all of these very shiny, poreless things that didn't quite have weight to them. And like I could see it developing as sort of this, the buzz of the future thing. And like even having seen Pixar's earlier shorts, I was not sold on the idea at all. I was so excited by the Disney Renaissance because I was a huge fan of Japanese animation at the time. And like Miyazaki at that point had already made Castle in the Sky, had already made My Neighbor Totoro, had already made Kiki's Delivery Service, Porco Rosso. And when I was seeing Disney catching up with the idea of animation that both adults and children could appreciate, animation that didn't feel like it was talking down to its audience, and animation that was just so lavishly, beautifully realized, I kept waiting for the Disney Renaissance to catch up with the Japanese ideal that adults watch animation too. And I was waiting for like the first American film that would actually be animation primarily for adults. And Pixar didn't achieve it with Toy Story, but I went into that movie just really with my hackles up, with my shoulders around my ears going, this is the wave of the future and I hate it. Mm-hmm. And I came out going, I didn't hate that and I don't know what to do with it. I mean, it was actually a baffling experience for me. And I wasn't nearly as sold on it back then as I am now. And maybe it was just because of that shock. Or maybe it was because I hadn't really seen how the Pixar mechanism can move people. And these characters weren't so tied into my conscience as well as like the collective pop culture conscience. But I, like my experience then and my experience now were very different, mm-hmm. partially because I was at such a different place in my life, which I imagine everybody else was too.
Well, and Pixar is in a totally different place too. It's interesting watching it now because you can see the seeds of so much of what would become, you know, the quote unquote Pixar touch, to note a book that Keith is holding over there. But yeah, it's, you know, like I said, you can see the seeds of so much of what the company would go on to do. And but you can also recognize how rudimentary it is on many levels. You know, there's the human characters, like they are rough by today's standards, you know, and there's kind of a sort of plasticky sheen to a lot of the movie that is, you know, looks very rendered to our modern CGI trained eyes. You know, none of that takes away from the ambition and innovation that Toy Story displays, but it's difficult to say that the animation necessarily holds up to modern standards because, you know, it doesn't, but you can still appreciate it for, you know, the starting point.
Although the characters visually have changed very little. Mm-hmm. I rewatched Toy Story and then I immediately rewatched Toy Story 3. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting there to be like a huge visual step forward in the characters. And while the human characters are very different, the backgrounds are very different, the ambition of the like the camera movement, the spaces are very different, the characters really don't look that different.
Well, that's like why Toy Story was such a smart way to do this first feature film, to make them about toys and to make things that don't move in a recognizable way. Like it's really interesting watching the quality of human movement in Toy Story. It looks like a video game cutscene. There's a certain like jerkiness to it. But the toys, they look perfectly natural because toys don't move like that. You can make it up, you know, in
quote unquote natural.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's what a stuffed cowboy string pull toy would move like, because we don't have any sort of frame of reference for that.
Yeah. How does it look now is sort of my next question. But I went back and looked at a bunch of old reviews, and what's interesting about so many of them is that I expected to read all about how people reacting to the technology, but if you go through like the major reviews like Janet Maslin and The Times, Richard Corliss and Time Magazine, Owen Gleiberman, it's all like they it's like, oh, it's like the first computer animated film, and here's why it's a wonderful story, and here's why this works, and here's why that works. Roger Ebert spent a little more time talking about his appreciation of the technology, but there's one point in the review where he just goes, but enough of this propeller head stuff, let's talk about the movie. Because it kind of like, and that was kind of my reaction in a way too, where like I went in ready to enjoy it, because I'd enjoyed pictures of other shorts when I watched, like, you went to Spike and Mike's festivals of animation.
Oh, yeah.
Things. Yeah, that was a regular thing for me, and they mm-hmm. were kind of staples of that. And so I knew the name enough to expect good things. But I guess the getting back to the 20 years later thing, what I didn't expect was this was the future. I thought that this would be, maybe this company would continue to produce some computer animated films that would appear side by side with traditional hand-drawn animation, which was the case for a while. But now, you know, in 2015, you know, try finding a hand-drawn feature.
I mean, I never thought that. And it was because Disney had been integrating computer animation more and more into its films. And I was reading so many interviews about, you know, how much easier it is to use this computer imagery to create the herd of buffalo in Lion King, to create the ballroom in Beauty and the Beast. The ballroom in Beauty and the Beast was the reason I hated computer animation. And
really?
Wait, you don't like the ballroom?
No, oh God, it's
so spinny.
It's very, very plasticky. It looks very fake. It doesn't integrate, and it doesn't have any of the warmth of a hand drawn thing. But the fact that Pixar was the one doing that, I was not aware of that until you brought that up, Keith.
Yeah, and Aladdin too. Like Aladdin, like explicitly credits Pixar. They worked on a couple of other ones like Rescuers Down Under, but like Disney wasn't really in the big hurry to publicize that there's computers involved in these in this animation stuff for fear of people kind of rebelling against it.
Well, they were by the time of the Lion King, because I remember that the buffalo or wildebeest, whatever the heck it is. The wildebeest stampede being like a huge talking point for them.
Yeah.
So, and I wonder if that was because by that time they thought the animation was good enough that they wanted to trumpet it instead of being quiet about it.
Well, and also it became too obvious to talk to not talk about. Like Aladdin has some very obvious computer effects and like there's like I forget the exact statistics, but there's like 3 multiplanar camera shots in The Little Mermaid, and there's like scores of them in Lion King because it's easier to fake with computer animation than to actually do. Like, I mean, not to get too technical, but the multiplanar camera is like a story high. It takes forever to work with.
For me, like that, I you can't underrate that Pixar ability to tell a story that children can understand, but tell it in a way that adults can emotionally experience. And that was something like The Lion King with Mufasa's death touched on something that I didn't think Disney animation was necessarily going to go to. That was what had given me the hopes that eventually we're going to see like a Disney film for adults. So there's stuff that happens in Toy Story that is really, as you say, kind of the rudimentary version of Pixar's like deep well of emotion. Mm-hmm. But it is some pretty like serious emotion. It is fairly touching at a couple of different points in that movie.
I think Buzz's existential crisis is one of the most affecting sequences in that movie.
I'm sorry. You're right. I am just a little depressed. That's all. I can get through this.
Oh, I'm a sham!
Shh, look at me. I can't even fly out of a window. But the hat looked good. Tell me the hat looked good.
You know, one thing going back and rewatching it, which I had not realized, is the degree to which this film more than the later Toy Story movies, like relies on Randy Newman to sell the emotion, like both in that sequence and in the opening, the You Got a Friend in Me sequence. All of what you know about the relationship between Andy and Woody and why it drives the rest of the story is summed up in that song and the montage of the two of them that you see during that song. And Pixar's moved away, and we can get into this with Good Dinosaur. Pixar's moved more and more away from that feeling of you have to have a song to sell the emotion and you don't need anything but a song to sell the emotion. Mm-hmm. But you see that a lot here. But for me, it was Toy Story 2 is where they like, really hit the mark. And that really shocked me because, you know, they were going to the sequel well so quickly.
It shouldn't have either, because it's not necessarily a movie that invites a sequel immediately, mm-mm. much less, with another one on its way. But those are great. You know, it's interesting to see that this is a world, their first world they created is also the one they keep returning to.
Mm.
Boy, I don't know. I just think the first one is the grand leap forward. I mean, this I just feel that though we're talking about Toy Story sort of created that, just started the visual style. It had a lot of elements that would recur later. I feel like this was the big revolutionary moment. I didn't feel like anything that happened afterwards was quite as strong, even though I would say, and maybe this is something we can talk about, there are elements that are maybe less familiar, like I think it may be Disney influence, which are jokes. we immediately go into the emotional resonance of Pixar films, and Toy Story certainly has that to a degree. But it's nothing like what we're seeing now, where we're all expecting to cry every time we go see a Pixar movie. What Toy Story has, I think, even over the other two stories, are jokes. Lots and lots of jokes and lots of adventure and fun and entertainment, I think.
And visual wit, too, like, which is something I think we don't see in Good Dinosaur as much, which I'm sure we'll get into in the second part of the episode.
Good Dinosaur is comparatively a very sincere film where there is... Mm-hmm. there's so much more sense in Toy Story, I think, of animators goofing.
But Toy Story has such an advantage being set in, you know, more or less our world and being able to, you know, reference recognizable things.
Yeah, one of those recognizable things being this. I had not noticed this, and I've seen this film a fair number of times, but I did not notice until this point that when the characters are stuck in the terrifying house of Sid, the next door neighbor who destroys toys, they have the carpeting from the Shining, the Overlook in the,
oh, really?
The Shining. Yes.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, when Woody's fleeing his room, there's this overhead shot and you're looking down on this carpet that's the same carpet that you were looking down on that's seen over and over, especially in room 237.
Yeah.
And then when I looked it up, I was like, are there other things like this that I'm missing? Apparently the number 237 crops up over and over in the Toy Story films.
It's
Yeah, Leon Critch, who's you know, had a long history with Pixar, apparently is a huge Shining fan and like continued to put hidden 237s you know, after the number of the room where something significant happens in The Shining. I don't want to spoil a film if you haven't seen the film. But the visual reference to the carpet caught me completely by surprise, and I had to loop back and watch it a couple times.
I guess we should probably talk about kind of how unlikely this film was that it actually happened and turned out as well as it did. Because, I mean, not to get into a long history of it, but Pixar, at one point, like I referenced it before, but there was like, is this a company that makes hardware, because they made Pixar computers for computer graphics, or is it a company that makes software? And like John Lasseter was kind of snuck in, because they always had, you know, ambitions to do animation, and John Lasseter was a former Disney animator who was stuck in a sort of like an interface technician, I believe was his first title there, and they brought in people that we now know very well, like Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton and the late Joe Ranft were all the people who did the story for Toy Story. They didn't have screenplay experience. It was the idea of whether or not you can get to translate what worked in shorts to feature length. At one point, they were supposed to do a TV special, but it became obvious that if the energy it would take to make a TV special, they may as well make a feature film. And you know, they got guidance along the way. Joss Whedon played a major part in the screenplay. It was Jeffrey Katzenberg, with whom they later become famously quite estranged, who said make it a buddy movie and had other like sort of key suggestions to keep it on track. And I don't know. It's just like one of those things where all this talent comes together at the right time. And I was watching it. I was wondering, would we even have computer animation, or you know, if we had computer animation, would it be on the scale that it is now, where it's sort of the dominant style, if there'd never been Pixar? I mean, Pixar is like seems like a very disruptive force in a really interesting way.
I can certainly see that. I've read some interesting interviews. I want to say with Lasseter, but it's hard to tell because I've read so many interviews with so many Pixar people. But somebody
conducted them.
This was not one of the ones that I conducted, though. This was probably one that I did as research for one of the ones I conducted. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure it was Lasseter talking about that first short that they did. What is it? The Adventures of Andre and Wally B.
Yep.
And how that was basically something that they, like, Lasseter didn't direct that, but he was the animation director. And they storyboarded it and created it as a short basically to highlight the software. That they like the RenderMan suite. And then they took it to trade shows. And at trade shows, people would come up to him and say, yeah, but what software did you use to make it so funny?
Uh-huh.
Like it was just assumed that there had to be like some kind of machine process that they were, you know, here's the button that you hit to make a shiny yellow surface. Here's the button you hit to make funny jokes. And like even from the beginning, people couldn't understand that this was a creative process, not simply a mechanical software process. And I mean, that just fascinates me. They had to have a juxtaposition that nobody else had at the time between these, like, as Ebert apparently says, propeller heads.
It's kind of equivalent of gearheads, though. I think it's the airplane equivalent of gearhead.
Fair enough.
But people who reacted, who didn't really quite understand that first short, by the way, included George Lucas. It's part of why he unloaded Pixar.
And I bet he's kicking himself now because of all the money he lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
He could have been rich.
I know.
We'd still be talking about George Lucas today. You know, the question, the hypothetical of whether or not, you know, we'd have computer animation today is obviously a hypothetical that we can't answer. But I do think, Keith, listening to you quote some of those reviews or talking about how the reviews kind of glossed over the technological innovation, it also made me think about how Pixar kind of taught us about this type of animation. And I think a lot of that kind of goes to the DVD and renaissance of the late 90s, early 2000s too, and featurettes and all that. I remember like the first probably 6 or 7 Pixar movies, watching all those making of featurettes and learning so much about what this means. Like, if to a layperson, what computer animation is and what is involved in it. And it's not just pushing a button and, you know, now your character jumps or whatever. You know, they're the idea of, you know, layers and textures and lighting effects and all that. It's a new visual language that filmgoers had to kind of learn. And I think Pixar was what taught them about it.
Yeah, Pixar's DVDs and Blu-rays are kind of an example of how you get it done. And another thing I learned is that in researching this was that some of the choices were made to show things to do things that could not be done with hand-drawn animation, like mm-hmm. plaid shirts. Mm-hmm. Plaid shirts would be almost impossible to do with hand-drawn animation, but you can, with computer animation, you can do that. And it's not necessarily something that we think of as lay people, but, you know, I think maybe subconsciously we register that stuff as things we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I feel like my feeling that, you know, of course computers are going to take over animation. Of course it's all going to look like this someday. When I was watching The Lion King, comes from a naive belief that, you know, using a computer makes it easy. And everything I learned about, like, the difficulty and complexity of computer animation in those early days came from those kind of mm-hmm. Pixar shorts.
Yeah, and it's almost gotten to... Well, no, it has gotten to the point now where whenever a new Pixar movie comes out, like, there's sort of a discussion of what is the big visual leap this time, you know, with Merida's hair or Sully's fur or Finding Nemo's water. Like, there's always, in Good Dinosaur, I'm sure we'll talk about the natural world and how it's represented there.
Well, I think they're pursuing animation's true dream, which is to become a live action movie. that's my Good Dinosaur joke. And enjoy that. But one simpler explanation too about maybe some of the reviews that Toy Story got and just reviews of animation in general is that it is a different language, and mm-hmm. it is a hard language to describe. It's a hard language for me to describe. It's not my strong suit, which is why I'm being a little bit quieter on this edition of the podcast, because it's
you very know, little of your beloved violence.
little of my, well, I mean, you know, in Japan they still deliver in Japan, but you know what I'm saying. It can be a tough language to describe, especially when we haven't really experienced it as we do as much with that first Toy Story.
And I mean, it's almost miraculous the degree to which they picked the exact right topic to teach us about this language, because they're dealing with these characters that are inherently made out of plastic. And so they not only have the right texture to them to be rendered, you know, in 1995 and 2015, like, in the same way and still look just as realistic. There's something really both creepy and awesome in Toy Story about how easy it is to make these toys look dead. You know, to when they kind of turn off, when people are around, all it takes is, like, letting the puppet go limp and taking the focus out of its eyes, and you get something that really does look like a toy lying on a surface. And I think that's just the fact that they found, somebody somewhere along the line must have said, you know, the surfaces we're creating look like plastic. What can we do with that? That's an interesting story. And again, you've got that juxtaposition of, here's what our software can do, here's what we can do creatively that nobody else had going on at the time.
Does anyone else want Toy Story 4 to be about Sid? You know, what happened to Sid?
I think that Sid is the garbage man in Toy Story 3. Seriously, he's wearing.
Oh, really?
Bob, my husband, pointed this out to me. He's wearing the same skull T-shirt.
Oh, really? Yes. Interesting. But I always feel like Sid was in some ways underappreciated because he's a very creative kid.
He is a very creative kid. I want to know what happened to the toys that he built.
Yeah.
You know, because after they scare the ever living crap out of him, like, I don't think he's going to take them back into his room. But all of you know, Woody's buddies just pack into the car and leave. Mm. It's kind of like, hey, thanks for helping us out, guys. We're out of here forever.
There's like a Wrath of Khan to be made, I think.
Spider baby.
As an adult, it's Island of Dr. Moreau. It's,
sure.
Or Island of Lost Souls.
I like to think that Hannah, Sid's sister, took in all of his toys and had tea parties with them.
She's responsible for my single favorite bit in the film, which is
Mrs. Nesbitt.
Yep, calling and him just and that just kind of continuing him just so dejected.
I'm Mrs. Nesbitt now. Yeah.
I think you've had enough tea for today. Let's get you out of here, bud.
Don't you get it?
You see the hat? I am Mrs. Nesbitt.
Before we move on to a new topic, Keith, I wanted to actually circle back to something you said, which was Joss Whedon's involvement in this. Mm-hmm. That, along with the Shining reference, was something that caught me by surprise that I'd completely forgotten about. And you say that he had a heavy involvement, and I'm curious if that comes from the Pixar touch or other research you did, because I know he was doing a bunch of like script doctoring at the time and just like joke writing. Was he like heavily involved in this from the beginning?
The Pixar touch we keep referring to is the book Pixar Touch by David A. Price, which is a pretty good history of Pixar up to like 2009 or so. A lot's happened since then. But the sense is that I get the feeling that he came in and was a lot of the actual structural work and screenplay. I get the feeling he was like, I don't think it's like an X-Men situation where you can point to like the two lines that he wrote. I think it's a little more heavily involved than that.
That's fascinating. I feel like that's something I need to do more research in. Is there's got to be an interview where he talks in detail about that experience.
I think your interview with him from years ago is one pretty good resource for it, if I'm not mistaken.
About Pixar? I don't remember.
Not Pixar, but I remember his script doctor days.
Oh, yeah, his script doctor days for sure. There are lines from that interview that I still quote to this day because he's so funny and because his expression was so weird. But
he's not a doctor. He's credited. He's a credited screenwriter.
Right. Yeah,
he's accredited. He's a credited screenwriter here. But I mean, when I did that interview, I looked at the IMDb to see what he was credited with and just kind of went through a list of like, what did you do on this? What did you do on this? And most of it was that kind of X-Men. Here are the two lines from it that they kept. So when I saw him come up on Toy Story, my first thought was, did he just punch up the jokes or was he involved? And given that Pixar tends to grab talented people and hold on to them with like all 4 feet, you see the same names cropping up over and over, becoming part of their brain trusts. I mean, I understand Joss Whedon having his own things that he wanted to go do, but it is sort of curious to me that they didn't have more of a relationship.
My understanding is basically, I think he probably had his own things he wanted to go do, but it was the way the credits break down is the story is credited to John Lasseter, Pete Docter, Anderson, and Joe Ramph, who are big Pixar people. The screenplay is credited to Joss Whedon, Andrew Stanton, Joel Cohen, and Alex, I don't pronounce his last name correctly, but Sokolow. And Joel Cohen and Alex Sokolow are kind of like Hollywood veterans who were brought in to, you know, give it a professional shine, basically. They went on to later to do Cheaper by the Dozen, Garfield the movie, Evan Almighty. Don't laugh.
These movies got made.
That was a real upward trajectory.
Not to laugh.
These are solid professionals. But yeah.
See, what computer animation can give us is the Garfield movie.
True.
Well, we talk about animation catching up. I mean, Pixar has obviously advanced, but looking at Toy Story, it's like, well, you know, kind of these, you know, mid-budget animation, computer animated films, they don't look better than Toy Story.
I disagree.
Really?
I think even like your Blue Sky animation
that's not mid budget though. Those are huge.
Oh, so you mean like Delgo and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, and just some stuff you see on TV. I mean,
TV is a whole different thing. Yeah. I thought you were just
those are real
trashing on your non Pixar animation houses, which does sometimes rankle me.
Yeah. But that I do that?
No. Just in general, like I feel like the impulse to compare every computer animated movie to Pixar is sometimes frustrating.
It's kind of unavoidable though, in a way. I mean, it's they were first, they're kind of the gold standard. And the track record is a lot stronger than any other person doing animation, any other house doing animation. It's kind of like, I guess it's like saying it's not Dom Perignon.
Well, and it's also harder to recognize and appreciate different house styles.
Sure.
A DreamWorks style or a Blue Sky style, which may not be to everyone's taste, but there may still be something there to appreciate.
It occurred to me also watching this that the joke they would not do was when Mr. Potato Head makes a reference to a hockey puck, and there's a hockey puck there, and it's sort of like a wink that this is Don Rickles doing the voice, and that's something that Pixar would never do now. Funny joke, though.
It's sort of a funny thing that does come out of that studio-to-studio comparison is there are a lot of people out there who do not make a distinction between, like, a Pixar movie means a computer-animated movie. Mm-hmm. There are people who don't know the difference, and I got no use for these people. These people can get off my stoop. But there's also a whole subsection of people who define any good computer animated movie. They assume it's Pixar. Mm-hmm. And I find that phenomenon just fascinating. So you see something like Wreck-It Ralph and people really assume that that's a Pixar movie.
I love Pixar's How to Train Your Dragon.
That was a pretty good Pixar movie.
Yeah.
Before we wind down this first half of the podcast, we should probably talk about the voice talent behind it, which is good choices, I think. Tom Hanks, I can't, well, at this point, I can't imagine anyone but Tom Hanks and Tim Allen in a lead, and the supporting cast all down the line is really great, too. It was almost Hanks and Billy Crystal, by the way. Billy,
oh, wow.
Billy
Crystal wait, he was in Monsters.
But he's great
yeah,
in Monsters.
Yeah, don't ugh.
Yeah, but he's, I mean, the shtick that he's doing in Monsters, Inc. works for that character. It really, really wouldn't have worked here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and also that character evolved to fit Tim Allen, because at one point he's supposed to be more like sort of over the top, very self-consciously heroic, and Allen's voice performance is more like a cop on the beat, so kind of like they tailored the character to fit what he was doing with the voice as well.
Repair my turbo boosters. Do people still use fossil fuels, or have you discovered crystallic fusion?
Well, let's see, we got double A's.
Watch yourself. Miles, who goes there?
Don't shoot.
It's okay,
friends.
Do you know these life forms?
Yes. They're Andy's toys.
All right, everyone, you're clear to come up. I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
Oh, I'm so glad you're not a dinosaur.
The choices are not necessarily expected. Wallace Shawn as the T-Rex is such an inspired bit of casting. Jim Varney as the Slinky Dog. Yeah,
Who took over for Jim Varney?
I'm not sure.
Somebody I'd never heard of. His name was Blake Clark. He was somebody I'd never heard of before. But I was actually just watching one of the featurettes on Toy Story 3, and they did an interview with him where he was a friend of Jim Varney's, and like he had a Jim Varney sort of impression that he would do with Jim Varney. So he gets very emotional talking about the loss of Jim Varney and like how unexpected it was and how doing the voice like makes him sort of hear his friend again, which I think is very touching.
Even Pixar's recastings are emotional. Gosh.
For me, Wallace Shawn, like as perfect as the Tom Hanks Tim Allen pairing is, Wallace Shawn is just, you know, he's the voice that you go to for like that level of hyper anxiety. And for me, that's the voice casting that just kind of makes this group of friends.
I treasure Tom Hanks as Woody just because exasperated Tom Hanks is my favorite Tom Hanks. It made me happy to hear Tom Hanks as Woody again.
And contempt. Like he actually has like does this sort of bristling contempt that is not really part of the...
I mean, Woody's kind of a jerk in this.
A lot of them are.
Like kind of all the toys are jerks in Toy Story.
Yeah, they're judgmental and they're very, very quick to like mob action.
They're like Springfieldians, you know.
Couldn't handle Buzz cutting in on your playtime, could you, Woody? Didn't want to face the fact that Buzz just might be Andy's new favorite toy. So you got rid of him. But what if Andy starts playing with me more, Woody, huh? You're gonna knock me out of the window, too?
I don't think we should give him a chance.
Here he is, man! Drag him!
Let's string him up by his pull string!
I got this on his head!
That's actually scaled back to make them more likable, because there's this incident like 2 years before it came out when Disney basically shut down production because the test reels, the characters were much less likable, and they felt like this film wasn't going to work. So I think they found the right balance with the final film.
I would love to see. I mean, did they fix that in scripting or did they fix that with the vocal work? Because some of the material here like could be just a little bit harsher and actually be really unpleasant. There's so much of this film is defined by jealousy and resentment and manipulation and, you know, selfish greed. Like I could see this script being the problem if the performances were just a little different.
Keep in mind, however, that the toys are all concerned that some other toys are going to come along and relegate them to the dustbin. So there's a bit of competition inherent in there. There's a bit of jockeying. So when Buzz gets knocked out the window, it makes a little bit of sense dramatically that Woody would want to do that.
You want to hear a political metaphor that people would be throwing tomatoes at me if I made this in public?
So are you about to make it in public on our podcast?
I'm about to make it within the studio where nobody can actually get to me with tomatoes. There was a point fairly early on in Toy Story where Woody is saying just with this like supercilious condescension, it doesn't matter how much we get played with. And they're like, yeah, says the guy who gets played with all the time, who's the favorite. And I was like, now we've got All Lives Matter. Hashtag All Lives Matter. That's it right there.
All toys matter.
All toys matter. It doesn't matter that some of us, meaning not me, don't get played with. Uh-huh. What matters is, well, really what matters is that I get played with. And like the knee-jerk level of like entitlement and resentment and condescension that is in his voice when he makes that speech. I was like, that's the All Lives Matter movement right there.
Well, he is a white male.
I wanted to actually avoid using the phrase white male privilege in order to avoid that knee-jerk. But yes, that is what I'm talking about.
This is a toy as well.
He's a white male toy.
Just to take this out of the whole metaphorical realm. He's a toy. He likes toys would rather...
Could you do that with the arm flailing and the Tom Hanks, he is a toy voice? Because that is one of the best moments.
This is a very surprising detour.
Before we get too political, perhaps we should wind down this half of the podcast. We'll move on to feedback. And perhaps some of you would want to leave some feedback for Tasha for that aside.
Bring the tomatoes.
Here is some... We got some really good responses to our last episode, which was about Battle Royale and the Hunger Game films. Tasha, why don't you share some of that with us?
All right. Well, here's an email we got from Ben S. Let's just read this quote. I don't know if you'll agree, but I've always interpreted Battle Royale as an almost satirical response to young adult media, or maybe the adolescent experience as a whole. When I watch it, I see all the angst, romance, anger, and intergenerational tension of a high school drama raised to its most extreme level, until any lingering realism gives way to the film's darkly comic absurdity. It becomes a world where events that only seem like life and death to a teen, such as a crush on a girl or a teacher having it in for you, actually become life or death. But of course, the warped reality that emerges is so weird and unbelievable that it throws the actuality of teen life into sharp relief. Things aren't all that bad, and all the shitty stuff you have to deal with isn't going to kill you, although maybe it feels like that sometimes.
Ooh, that's a really good response to the film. Rachel sort of brought that up, did a really good job of kind of talking about Battle Royale as a film about teenagers in a way that Hunger Games isn't. But it is interesting to think about it, about the film as that as being the primary text of the film. It makes sense, their behavior. If you, I don't know. It's all there in the letter, but I thought it was very cleverly. I think that's a very clever interpretation.
I did too. I mean, I think one of the things that becomes interesting about Battle Royale is the degree to which people feel freedom to express their deep-seated hidden crushes and emotions to each other because they're about to die. And I kind of feel like that is, as Ben says, kind of throwing all of these emotions into sharp relief by making them revealable literally only on pain of death, but also just like giving everybody the wherewithal to finally come out and say what they're feeling, I think might feel like catharsis to people who are actually holding back these kinds of emotions.
Scott, would you like to share another email we received?
I would like to share one. So Dante K wrote in to flesh out our understanding of how Battle Royale fit into Japanese history, specifically the clashes between student protesters and the authorities in the late 1960s. His email is too long to share in full here, but we'll post it on nextpictureshow.net. Here's the gist in the meantime. Dante writes, there are many incidents of students barricading themselves in the schools, boycotts, class walkouts, strikes, and some instances of firebombing. Clashes with police became so frequent that the government passed laws giving university administrations more power for dealing with students, which included harsh penalties for protests of any kind. Because of this, the idea that the government may get to a point where they outright kill students to keep them in check becomes a very real hypothetical.
I want to read the rest of the letter. I'm fascinated.
It's good stuff.
I mean, I knew that it tied into history, but not to that degree. Like, I knew that it was specifically about that feeling that apparently every generation gets, that the youth are running wild and this is going to be the last generation. But as far as the specifics, the political specifics, I didn't know about that.
Well, we appreciate all your feedback and would love to hear more from you about this in future episodes. To share your thoughts about Toy Story, The Good Dinosaur, or both, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half of this week's conversation, we'll take a closer look at Toy Story as it relates to The Good Dinosaur, and consider what both tell us about Pixar's evolution over two decades. Plus, you'll get to hear this.
Yeah, they're good. They're all very good dinosaurs.
Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at NextPicturePod, so you'll always know when the new episode drops. Also, if you get a chance, give us a review. That helps. Until then, remember the claw is our master.
The claw.
You're gonna see it's our destiny. friend in me. You got a friend.